our two esteemed speakers, and then we'll be opening it up for questions and discussion from participants in the call. What we do ask is that you mute your phones when you're not speaking, otherwise we get feedback messages from your surroundings. So if you could please do that, that would be great. We won't be doing introductions because we have over 50 people registered for this call today. But when you come to asking any questions or making any comments, please do introduce yourself. So my name is Rupert Downing, and I'm your moderator today. My background is I'm the director of the Canadian Social Economy Research Hub, which is a national research program on the social economy that joins together universities and colleges and practitioner organizations, civil society associations from across the country. It's funded by the Social Science and Humanities Research Council, and we're just coming up to about the sixth year for some of us of doing this research program. One of the issues that has come up as we've done this work across the country is the importance of the social economy and its various subsectors and organizations to actually delivering on environmental issues that our communities face across Canada, particularly in terms of sustainability of our communities and of our economic activities. So we're very interested in that trend, and at the national level, Rochelle and I are actually working on an e-book that tries to sum up what the evidence is of the importance of the social economy in delivering on not only social and economic sustainability issues, but also environmental sustainability issues. So we felt that this particular telelearning session, one of a whole series that we're organizing, different thematics and subjects that have emerged as being important in our research and knowledge mobilization work. We thought it was important to have this one that really looks at how environmental sustainability movements and agendas are converging with those of the social economy. So our two speakers are going to share for about 10 minutes some of the work they've been doing and perspectives that they bring. We've asked each of our speakers to address three questions that are kind of the focus. And what sort of evidence there of environmental sustainability and the social economy having converging agendas? Secondly, what is unique and promising about this convergence? And then thirdly, what are some examples and ideas that set up this emerging trend? So those are the three questions that we're going to be kind of focused on. In addition to the telephone engagement and interaction, we do have a chat room for people to log into, which we'll use to deal with suggested resources, questions, etc. And you can log into that chat room now at http://www.chatzy, that's chatzy.com/CSE Hub. You should find that information also in the material that was sent to you for the call. So because we have limited time, we want to give people a chance for questions and discussion. I'm going to move straight ahead, introduce our first speaker, who is Mike Lewis, and Mike is the Executive Director of the Canadian Centre for Community Renewal, as well as the director of the BC Alberta Regional Research Program under the Social Economy Research, the acronym for the BC Alberta Social Economy Research Center is BALTA, B-A-L-T-A, and they, of course, have a website, which I'm sure Mike will share with us. And Mike has authored a number of papers on this kind of issue of the social economy and environmental issues, one of which we've given you as a resource, A Great Transition, Navigating Social, Economic, Ecological Change in Turbulent Times, which he co-authored with Patrick Connerty. So without further ado, Mike, I'm going to pass it over to you, and we welcome your comments and observations.
Okay, thank you, Rupert. Welcome, everybody. I wanted to start, I looked at the list of people that were on this call, kind of the general networks, and it reminded me of a workshop we're doing in Stockholm, Pat and I, and it was all around kind of peak oil, climate change, alternatives, all of this kind of stuff, and it was very interesting. I mean, we had people from the Jack Cooperative Bank, Transition Town Sweden. We had people from the municipality. We had people from business. We had people from university. There was economics students, profs, co-ops, and people from the National Climate Change Campaign Office, Peak Oil, and a couple of trade unionists, all kind of gathered. And it was fascinating to see this kind of convergence taking place across all of these constituencies. And after we made our little presentation, the national head of the climate change campaign stood up and said that she just wanted to open the discussion by saying that one of the things that they were recognizing is that campaigning is important, but it's not enough. And that really their challenge in their heads was, how do we rethink how we organize our economic life differently? So, you know, this is essentially core to a lot of the research that we've been doing in Balta, and certainly some of the stuff that Pat and I are working on right now in a major book. There's imperatives that are driving this. I don't think I'm going to spend any time on that. I think, you know, most of the people on this call will know that climate change, that our dependence on fossil fuels, peak oil, and the fact that according to the Millennium Assessment report 4 years ago, 60% of our ecosystems are in serious danger. The question is, okay, what are the implications of this for our current predicaments? In macro terms, clearly, you know, in our view, and based on all of the research we've been doing, globalization and kind of the ideology of economic growth is kind of part of our fundamental predicament. It's not sustainable by any measure. It's like driving towards the edge of a cliff and stepping on the accelerator to think that growth is the way out of the predicament we're in. Big questions on the macro side are, how do you move to a steady state economy, or some would argue a strategic retreat from growth altogether. And second, you know, we know that the dependence on the global economy on fossil fuels is total, so that we're going to have a situation where as prices for fossil fuels continue to move between higher peaks and subsequent higher valleys as kind of recession set in, just as we've seen in the last couple of years, we are presented with this key challenge. How do we reweave our economic life on a more local and regional basis? So, in terms of the innovation side of this, we found ourselves in Balta and many other people elsewhere involved in an emerging body of research that revolves around trying to understand what I call strategic pathways, that is, innovations that help us relocalize our economic life, especially around how we meet our basic needs, food, energy, finance, shelter. So, you know, in 10 minutes, and I'm four in, let me just put out some teasers here that I think are pertinent to our discussion. What if I told you that by removing land from being a commodity on the market, we could reduce the cost of housing by 30 to 50%? What if I told you that by holding land in vehicles such as community land trusts, that $50,000 provided by taxpayers today to help making housing affordable would keep that unit of housing affordable permanently. Where if you took the land that's not kept out of the market, that taxpayers subsidize for that initial $50,000, that over 30 years, at 5 sales, you'd have $850,000 in subsidies to keep the same unit affordable. You can take a look at the Champlain Housing Trust. It's referenced in the paper that you've got. So with that idea of a different kind of tenure for land, which is important not just in terms of housing, but how do we deal, for instance, with the crisis that's emerging where the average age of a farmer in Canada is 57, that they tend to be asset-rich and cash-poor, and that succession, that is, how is the next generation of farmers going to come into play, is really a looming crisis. And what if I told you that, like the housing example, this can be achieved by organizing what we call a duplex type of ownership, where the land is taken out of the market, put in a trust, leased back to a new farmer who can then afford to finance the house and building on their own. There are several examples across North America and increasingly in Europe where this is taking place. It's a complicated transaction, but the way in which the community organizes a social and community ownership and links it back to social goals is absolutely fundamental to making any of these happen. What if I told you that CED and social economy organizations are playing a key role in organizing local and regional consumer markets for food based on ecological and fair trade principles? It's happening. Key to scaling it up is rebuilding the local and regional infrastructure to support growth of local food. For example, processing, storage, labor. Indeed, most of the local infrastructure in many parts of the country, including, for instance, Vancouver Island, where only 5% of our food is now grown on the island, this infrastructure has been hollowed out by globalization and reliance on commodity markets and export markets. Rebuilding this is anything but easy, but where progress is being made, multi-stakeholder organizations that bring producers, consumers, local private business, co-op, and nonprofit actors together into focused efforts over time is where the innovation is taking place. We cannot reorganize for transition in the context that we are living today unless we have means by which cooperation can be structured in business-like, focused, and sustainable ways. You can look at Saikatsu, which is mentioned in the paper, Japan. You could look up Heritage Food Services Co-op in Vancouver Island that are putting these pieces together, the Small Food Processors Co-op. There's a lot of research on farmers market, which is just one component. Pulp has done some of that work, but it's only one component, obviously, of local transition. And there's a lot of innovation taking place, and the social economy organizations are right at the heart of it. Just looking where I'm at here, yeah, got a couple of minutes.
Yeah, please, yeah.
So what if I told you that financing transition to a different kind of economy is one of our most major challenges, and that the very basis for most credit, that is our ability to pay compound interest over time, mm-hmm. is one of the driving factors that's keeping us always on this growth trend. The embedded cost of compound interest requires us to grow or we collapse from a financial point of view. How do we get off the treadmill? In the paper that you've got, there's mention of the Jack Cooperative Bank in Sweden. They charge fees for finance, not interest. Huge impacts on housing costs, for instance. But they also have been innovating in very significant ways in terms of ecologically focused and social enterprise and mobilizing local capital through financing. financing that's fee-based, not compound interest-based. They would argue very clearly that compound interest is part of the problem in terms of driving economic growth, and that a different kind of financing is absolutely required if we're going to transition to a steady-state economy. You'll also find in that paper very interesting stuff on energy conservation, carbon at the household level of heating. The example that we featured there is Kirk Lees in England. Clearly, it's multi-tiered partnership, but the important and absolutely critical thing that is coming out of the European experience is that between municipal governments and local level, that the social enterprise, nonprofit kind of model that can coordinate and integrate a wide range of services into a persistent and effective package at the local level is absolutely fundamental. So there's much more to be said. I always find 10 minutes more of a challenge than an hour. So I'll leave it there for now. I think the key things are, obviously this transition to a sustainable local and regional economy is a fundamental challenge. All of us, social, community, and cooperative ownership are key features of the most promising innovations. Ownership is key. Without local ownership, there's no basis for reinvestment. Without a means to invest and reinvest in local transition, we will not sustain the means to reach sustainability. That's it for now, Rupert.
Very good. Thank you, Mike. That was great. So hold your questions and comments until after we've heard from Emmanuel, our next speaker. Emmanuel Lapierre-Fortin is an MSc candidate in rural planning and development at the University of Guelph, and she's a transition towns trainer, actively involved in Transition Guelph, and is a past member of the Emerging Leaders Committee of the Canadian CED network. And so let's hear from Emmanuel now. Emmanuel, are you there?
Yes, I'm here. Can you hear me?
Yes, hear you loud and clear.
Okay, perfect. So, hi, everybody. Great to see such a great turnout for this call. My research specifically focuses on climate change and peak oil at the municipal and community level. And so, follow up on Mike's idea of the importance of ownership, I will be speaking mostly to community-owned renewable energy initiatives as a promising area for the economy and environmental sustainability. One thing I think is really promising about this intersection is that the green jobs market is really growing, I think, in Canada and around the world. And so what I mean by green jobs is usually the UN definition, which defines broadly green jobs as positions that contribute to substantially preserving or restoring environmental quality. And so some examples would be environmental engineers, brownfield redevelopers, energy, renewable energy workers, and that type of thing. And so what we find is that there are a lot of opportunities in that area. Just, for example, in Europe, there was 100,000 new jobs that were created just with community power, and that most analysts say that there would be more jobs that would be created in renewable energy, recycling, and public transportation than all the jobs that are going to be lost in the oil and coal industries and car manufacturing as oil...
The conference is in lecture mode.
And as oil peaks, then we're going to be depending more and more on renewable energy for our energy needs. And so this rise in green jobs is happening at the same time as the global economic crisis. And in the Ontario context, which is the one that I'm most familiar with, the recession kind of hit at the same time as the government announced the Green Energy Act. Which
the conference is no longer in lecture mode.
Which is basically a new legislation that allows people to sell renewable energy to the grid and get a feed-in tariff for their contribution. And that whole energy act is supposed to bring 50,000 new jobs, green jobs, in Ontario. And so in that context, Ontario has seen green job listings increasing annually by 40%, and a context in which there is a shortage even of skilled labor in some industries like solar panels and that type of thing. And so there is a real consensus among green business owners that this is a growth area, that there's great potential. And so to me, I see that green enterprise development and the social economy could really go hand in hand in that. And so I know that Mike's paper talks about sustainable development and ecological economics really, really well and eloquently, so I won't get too much into that. But I think that it's really important that in speaking of the social economy and community economy development, we always think of adding that environmental sustainability lens to our discussions, because environmental issues like climate change and peak oil will become the defining issues of our century. And so this presents, as much as it is a crisis and it presents danger, it also presents a lot of opportunities for social economy businesses to tap into those markets. And green economic development and social economy, they share a lot of the same philosophy. For example, community power is defined by the Ontario Sustainable Energy Association in such terms as it is locally owned, it is accessible to local participants, it is democratically controlled, and a lot of the businesses in community energy are cooperative. And so that link, I think, can be exploited a lot more. And in the paper that I present and the website, the one on the role of CED organizations in green enterprise development, I take the position that really there are fundamental links between the two, and there's a lot of opportunities for integration, because community economic development is itself an integrated approach that mobilizes multiple forms of capital, not only economic capital and human capital, but also natural capital. And so in my paper, you will see that I present some areas in which CED, community economic development organizations, are really active, and some roles that can be transferred into green jobs development, green enterprise development. And so some of the roles in the paper are, for example, providing financing, engaging in business retention and extension and capacity development, network, and that type of thing. And so to go into the other question about what are some examples of activities in which there is already convergence, I think this is something that in the CED sector we've seen more and more talk about environmental sustainability even in the next year. I think the fact that we're having this call is really encouraging. The CCCR, the organization that Mike works for, is working with Transition Towns. The Canadian CED Network has a focus on green jobs for the new phase of their Create Action internship program. So there's a lot going on. For today, I'm going to be speaking mostly to one community power cooperative, and also I'm going to be talking a little bit about Transition Towns. And I know that we can talk about a lot more examples also in the discussion later. And so when I say community power, I think this is really one of the biggest opportunities for the social economy, because electricity is one of the areas in which there's the most leakage in the economy. It is estimated, actually, that for every dollar, there's 70 to 90 cents that leave the community and never return. And so community power is a key aspect to plug the leaks in the economy. And in the Ontario context, with the Green Energy Act, there is a lot of opportunities for new cooperative wind businesses, cooperative solar panel businesses. And we're really thinking of a model that, like, currently it's more industrial-based. Like, there's a lot of really large wind development in Ontario and across Canada. But that's not the only model. If you look at Denmark, for example, there's 100,000 family co-op members of windmill cooperatives in Denmark, and 80% of all the wind turbines are cooperatively owned. So one really promising example we have in Ontario is called the Toronto Renewable Energy Cooperative, and I've done a bit of research on the organization, and they are mostly famous for having, they're operating the commercial wind turbine at Exhibition Place in Toronto, so I don't know if some of you have come back across that wind turbine, but that's run by TREC. And their mission is to basically inspire citizens to work together, pool their resources, and realize sustainable, fair, and accountable energy economy. And they're doing that through both building community-based and owned renewable energy projects, and also educating Ontarians and visitors about renewable energy, energy efficiency and conservation, and the model of community power. And one of the models that I would invite you all to have a look at is the project by TREC. It's called WindShare, and it's in first of its kind project in Ontario that it's a cooperative that the wind power for-profit business that is going to put 10 new turbines of 2 kilowatts each near Lake Huron in Ontario, and they're going to be generating revenue from selling their power to the grid through the feed-in tariff program, which is now possible because of the Green Energy Act. And they are going to be starting to generate power in early 2012, and they are looking for people to invest. You know, as a cooperative, people can become members, and they can also get a really high return on their investment for this project. And one thing that I found in looking at TREC is that as a cooperative, it fulfills most of the roles that other community economic development organizations fulfill. And so there are really a lot of intersections between sort of CED organizations that are not so much into the environmental sustainability realm, and those that are. A lot of occasions to be learning. And the second example I want to talk about is Transition Towns. And so this is Transition Towns is the movement that aims to increase resilience to to climate change and peak oil in Canadian communities. And as of September, there were 17 Transition Towns in Canada. I'm personally involved with the Transition Town in Guelph. And you can see that there are a lot of intersections with community economic development and Transition Towns. Transition Towns have a lot of local food projects. They do a lot of reskilling, so they train people into doing things like canning and having backyard chickens, and they encourage having local currency. And so there is it's a lot of a similar philosophy. And if you want to talk more about Transition Towns during the discussion period, I'd be more than happy to. Just moving on to the last question, some examples for scaling up this emerging trend. And I'm glad this is one of the questions, because I think that this really has a lot of potential. And if we want to make a significant difference, we really have to scale up those initiatives. And so I think that what Mike was saying about like having to transform ownership is really, really important. And with that comes the idea of having adequate financing for projects like community energy. In Ontario, we're really lucky because we already have 2 programs that are really, really innovative and forward-looking. The first one is called the Community Power Fund, and it was established in 2007 to support project development activities of Ontario-based community organizations that are pursuing local renewable energy projects. And so they provide support, they provide grants, loans, and investment equity as well. There's also the Community Energy Partnership Program, which makes grants in the amount of $200,000 available to community groups to fund the soft costs of getting started with a community power project, so like business planning and technical studies, that type of thing. So those things together are really interesting models that I don't know if there are similar examples outside of Ontario, but those are 2 good ones from Ontario. I think to scale it up, we really also need, as a movement, to really make the business case for things like energy efficiency, because really, everyone saves money from gaining in energy efficiency. And so if we put the numbers out there, and the numbers are available through the Ministry of Natural Resources, through the Rocky Mountain Institute, and really convince business owners, not only those that are involved in environmental sustainability, but really all businesses can make like save money from like spending less on electricity. And so having those numbers out there would be really important in terms of getting like a really broad sweeping range of businesses to go green finally. And still on the financing part, there is an emerging concept of green microcredit around the world. And so microcredit being providing small loans to entrepreneurs that want to start up. This idea of green microcredit is basically doing it but for for green projects, for green enterprises, so small-scale energy businesses, sustainable agriculture, that type of thing. So that really can help create market demand by making it accessible for people to start up in that industry. And I think that's something that the Community Futures Development Corporation would really have. They could gain from looking into it because they also make larger loans, not only macro loans, but also bigger loans. So by educating CFDC loan managers and board of directors on green enterprise concepts, we can assist them in making better lending decisions. And I think as local organizations, I think a lot of people are coming and representing local organizations across the country. I think something that we can all do to help it, help scale this up is to engage in capacity building at the regional business and individual level by talking about those concepts of green enterprise, by talking about it some more. And some other things we can do is like a regional asset mapping to see where our green industries are, what are our strengths in our region, and also how we can network together, like put the businesses in contact so that they can have a stronger voice. So just, you know, like that can also involve working one-on-one with businesses and also like making sure that there's some continuous learning opportunities for learning about those things, because green job is a sector that evolves really, really quickly. And so there's definitely an opportunity for continuous learning. So NCED organizations are usually really good at that. They're really good also at strategic planning and management. And so if each of us within our CED organizations were committed to creating a green vision for our neighborhoods, our communities, and our regions, I think this would be a real asset, because it's unavoidable that like we're going to have to go green constraints that are coming up in climate change. So we better start planning now. That's my position. And so one last point before concluding. One thing that the Green Job Strategy, the Midwestern Ontario Regional Green Job Strategy is the full name of the organization. They did a survey of 84 business green enterprise owners in Ontario. And they found that their respondents thought that the biggest issue, the one that would have the greatest impact on the growth of their business, is something related to government programs or regulation. So one thing that I think is, and that's really important and we shouldn't discard, is those programs, for example, like the home energy audit tax credit that was available and has now been cut off. That was a huge help in getting people across the country to do energy audits in their homes. And so those programs really have to be there and available for people to incentivize them to, you know, increase their energy efficiency. And those programs really also create job opportunities that the social economy can tap on. And so that's really an important point. So just in conclusion, I think that the CED and the social economy has really a great collective nature. And there's a lot of work that's being done in local food and local money. And all of this really does help environmental sustainability through relocalization, as Mike said. But I think we can also do a lot more. And there are some great resources that are coming out of the Rocky Mountain Institute, for example, the Community Energy Workbook. And there's a lot coming up on the website workgreen.ca. That's the Green Job Strategy website. They do a lot of fantastic work in Ontario. And so I think that like we need to start to think of the community as an incubator for green jobs and see how we can tap on those opportunities, because really everybody and their grandmother is moving into this sector of green jobs and renewable energy. It's the sunrise sector. And it would be a big mistake for the social economy to not go into that direction. It's a really strategic direction that I think we really need to go into. And it not only talks about people as consumers of electricity, but I think that's also somewhere that we can all play roles as citizens. And so that's it for my presentation for now, and I really look forward to the discussion. So thanks for listening.
Very good. Thank you, Emmanuel. That's some excellent suggestions in terms of scaling up the convergence. So we'll open it up for questions and comments from folks. So I'm just going to just remind you, just please do very briefly introduce yourself when you contribute, and of course remember to unmute your line if you do. So would anybody like to volunteer to give us our first contribution?
Rupert?
Yes.
It's David here in Ottawa.
Right, David.
Emmanuel, could you, you mentioned very quickly, and I found it interesting, you spoke of transition towns regarding food. If you could elaborate a bit on that, and if that comes out, like Mike referred to his paper occasionally, is that also linked to particularly to one of your papers? If you could elaborate a bit on that, too.
Okay. Thank you, David. Sure. So one of the papers is actually a PowerPoint presentation that's up on the Social Economy Hub website. It's called Transitioning Food, Local Food, CED, and Reskilling in Transition Towns. And so that's a presentation that I did at the Association for Nonprofit and Social Economy Research Conference, that basically, in which I looked at the transition towns across Canada and what they were doing in terms of reskilling and local food. So the reskilling part is the part in which transition towns are like providing a lot of workshops and informal education opportunities for people to relearn skills that's useful for relocalization that are being lost. So like canning, drying, preserved food, like by drying, and all those skills that maybe migrant, but that as, you know, a young adult, a lot of those skills were not really taught to me. And so the presentation looks at what's happening in Canada in terms of local food. And so just in transition wealth, for example, we have a working group. Most transition towns work under a working group model in which there's an initiating committee that gets started, and then people put their energy and their leadership behind a specific issue. And so our food and permaculture group in Guelph has been doing lots of garden tours. So they get people together to go to different gardens and look at the permaculture design of how it's working out in those gardens that they visit. And so there's that. And there's been a workshop on backyard chickens, because we have a bylaw that allows that in Guelph. And so that's one way that, you know, we can have more local food by having eggs in your backyard and six chickens.
Right.
Across Canada, like, food, I found, is the number one working group in transition towns across Canada. And the Ottawa transition towns have been really active in that. They've done, a big sort of workshop in this pollinator garden, and they taught people how pollinators, like bees and that type of thing, are really important to creating gardens with native species. And so, like, if you want to find out more, like, I'd invite you to look at my presentation. There's things about transition towns across Canada. But that's really, I think, a key sector. Food is, with energy, I think, are, like, some of the biggest the sectors with the most leverage and the most opportunity to make a difference in terms of adapting and mitigating climate change and peak oil.
Great. Thank you, Emmanuel.
Thank you.
Thanks, David. Any other questions from people on the call?
Hi, it's Sherry Torsman in Ottawa.
Hey, Sherry.
Hi. Thank you both for your fantastic presentations. I was wondering, in terms of transition to local economies, can you talk about the kinds of policy changes that you think would be necessary at the federal level, in particular, to enable or support the kinds of changes that to which you referred, both in, you know, sort of credit and banking and finance, training and reskilling, the legislative framework to which you referred. Can you speak briefly to that, either Mike or Emmanuel?
Sure. Thanks for your question. And as a planning student, usually thinking in terms of municipal government, and so the federal legislation is not really my forte. So I'll try to answer your question, but I think that would also have really good impact for you. Federal legislation, I just have to admit, first off, that I'm not very optimistic about the opportunities with our current federal government. I think that many of you probably share my impression that this government is not providing any leadership in terms of climate change. And so in that current context, to me, I'm thinking that, you know, this is really one case in which municipal government and community organizations are really going to have take this issue of relocalization within our own ends, and we really can't wait for the federal government to be coming up with policies and regulations, because it's not really happening. until we have a change of government, I just don't really see it happen, to be quite honest. So I'm a little bit pessimistic. I don't know if, Mike, you have something you'd like to say about this question.
Mike. Hello, Mike, are you there? No, okay. I'll just make a comment on this
I'm
issue.
Back.
Okay.
Sorry, I was hitting the wrong button. I so seldom mute myself.
Okay. Please, Mike, go ahead.
You know, obviously procurement at every level of government is an important lever.
Right.
It's obvious that at most levels of government, particularly at the federal, outside of the Aboriginal setting, procurement is not a tool that is in any way that I can see at this point at the federal level being utilized with social purpose in mind, or transition, or ecological purpose for that matter.
Right.
Second, we're in fact headed federally in directions that are almost counter to the things that we're talking about here.
Yeah.
In particular, for instance, you know, the trade negotiations going on with Europe are absolutely, completely counter to any kind of use of procurement, even at the municipal level. Very explicit, very clear, you know, and that's on the table. And those kinds of discussions reflect, I think, you know, the bias of this government to a particular ideological perspective around the market, determining what is the value, period. We've had lots of that in this country. So I'm not particularly optimistic around the current government. I do think that the federal government could play a role both in tax policy and tax credits that could help drive and help enable ownership on social and community ownership. Now, that's possible. Is it probable? Not with this government.
Right.
So, I think, you know, even the regional feed-in tariffs in Ontario for renewable energy, I don't know if people have noticed, but they're under attack through the WTO, the World Trade Organization, right now. Japan, U.S., Europe, all are arguing very strenuously against it. Now, I don't think we necessarily have to worry about it, but we do have to understand that the politics of what we're talking about are counter to the economic growth and a kind of market driven ideology which still dominates much of our thinking and much of our kind of cultural patterns in Canada and many other places. So this is a very tough one, and I think it's really important that we understand that on the one hand, the kind of transitions I talked about are kind of examples, can be driven locally and regionally, but there are some that really do require our public governance mechanisms and our ability to, you know, use tax and fiscal policy to encourage this kind of innovation and transition. It's absolutely, both are important. And that, at the end of the day, so is resistance to certain policies, and that are counter to local and regional economies. It's very, very tough, and it's not just at the government level. Trying to deal with procurement for universities for local food, it's tough, tough, tough. There's all kinds of rules, including rules that they look at very, very carefully, because it's a public institution. If they start putting out tenders for local food that contravene the free trade agreement, these are the kinds of issues that come up all the time. So, and we got lots of provincial barriers as well. People like Herb Barbalet and others could tell you better than I, who are online. You know, whether it be meat processing, the centralization patterns in the food sector. I mean, we're running counter to already exist. existing food system at which there's very real interests that reflect themselves both in the industry and in terms of the, for instance, in agriculture, the dominant lobby, which is based on, you know, five major corporations that control 70% of the food system in Canada. And we continue to have a very export-oriented federal and provincial policy frame related to food. So these things are multi-tiered, they're complex. Transition is a political process as well, a very active and innovating process. So there is a movement building aspect to this as well.
Mm-hmm.
Sorry for going on so long.
Very good. Okay. Thanks, Mike. And just one comment from me. My role as executive director here of the Community Planning Council for Greater Victoria, it seems to me that one of the leverage points in terms of the public policy environment is for addressing this kind of area is the gas tax requirements on municipalities to come up with sustainability plans that address social, economic, and environmental issues. And so, for example, here in the capital region is finally developing a local food and agriculture policy that stakeholders are engaged in helping to co-construct. So there is a bit of a leverage point across the country because of the federal gas tax requirements to do this sustainability planning for the municipality's share of the gas tax. And the provinces could be stepping in more actively to support that kind of work with the civil society organizations. That's, I think, an area of public policy that we should be looking at more seriously.
Good. Thank you so much. Yeah.
Thanks for the question, Sherry. That's great. Any other questions or comments that people have?
Yeah, it's Ambrose here. I just wanted to add to that as Michael was saying, there is a pretty strong international global market out there, and I think the role of the community-based development is really to build an alternative economy based around local energy, food, and necessities. And while we don't have a strong position at this point, as one's built and the energy prices start to change, then our position will become stronger. So I think that the target that we're looking at in this area is to try and get some prototypes developed to get the science or the culture of local economy building, so that when the real need for it happens, we have some alternatives that we can move into, because the energy prices will undermine the existing system quite dramatically, and will position the community-based ones to be able to expand rapidly if they have the culture built into their communities. So I see that as the sort of the hopeful component of it, despite my my distrust of the current federal government.
Excellent, yeah.
That's great, Ambrose. Thank you.
Can I just make a comment, Ambrose? It's Mike. I take your points. I think it's absolutely true. I think there's a lot of prototypes that are already in play. I think our ability to contextualize them where we live or in our regions and our own understanding of all of this is still, we know and we sense the urgency, but the actual prototypes that are out there are not yet well communicated, or the knowledge that is emerging very rapidly is not being mobilized in a very targeted way. So that's one thing. The second thing I would say is that that municipalities in the Canadian context, we have a major problem. If you take the point that I'm making, which is that we are going to be forced by circumstances, and are already some evidence of this, that we're going to have to reweave our economies on a more local and regional basis around basic needs, then it's absolutely a problem for us, the current fiscal and tax system in Canada, because municipalities are so marginalized in terms of tax points, right? They get 8% of the tax take in Canada. We need to have ways in which our tax resources can be located in localities in a much more significant way than we do right now. And I think the gas tax was Paul Martin's way of trying to deal with that. But we have, both within provincial governments and in particular, a real hesitance to move in this direction, as well as the federal level. So I think this, our coalition building and how we see putting interests together have to include municipalities. And I would say that among the more promising things going on in context is the level of awareness and some of the work actually taking place and being supported by various federations and municipalities. Certainly in our exposure to municipalities, you know, they're on the ground. They have a sense of, you know, of what's going on and what the challenge is. And they're asking some of the best questions, in my view. Certainly more pointed and focused questions than one sometimes finds at the federal or provincial level.
Very good. Thank you. So, any other questions or comments? Please don't be shy. We welcome any comments or questions.
Hello, this is Alan Williams in Kelowna, BC. I'm just wanting to follow up on the posting that I made on the chat list here. I just was curious to know if anyone is aware of any initiatives for community control of electric vehicle charging outlets. I just noticed that General Electric is setting up a system of glow sticks. They're going to be multicolored little poles that are going to be able to be usable for people charging electric vehicles. Now, I'm just wondering if they're going to be doing this as a monopoly or whether there's any kind of way that local groups will have some control over electric vehicle filling.
Interesting question. Anybody on the call have any response to that?
Don't have a clue, but I don't see why it couldn't be. I mean, you have major, for instance, if you want to look at energy and locality and ownership, I mean, I think, you know, there's examples that are municipal-owned and cooperatively-owned enterprises that are capturing local energy, whether it be from a renewable point of view, from a retail point of view, or from a, you know, from a, you know, a delivery kind of service point of view. All of those, there are examples more so in Europe than I have found in Canada, although they're emerging in Canada. And there's no reason why we can't do that. We do have some district energy systems that I think are very important and that are sometimes being fed by bio waste and so on that are showing real promise of, you know, dealing with the efficiency question, carbon reduction, and you know, much more sustainable base for you know, the inputs into district heating systems. Revelstoke, for instance, British Columbia, has done that, and it's kind of a jointly municipal and community-owned enterprise. So there's no reason why.
One of the points I thought that would be very valuable is we looked at what was going on in Europe and how the social structures that they use to develop their progressive technology. And one of the things that came up, hard talking over the music, but one thing that came up is this concept of collaborative community decision making. This became sort of key to being able to get the level of broad participation that communities needed to bring in some of these large-scale projects. I'm just wondering if people wanted to comment on that.
I'm not quite sure, Ambrose. I haven't heard that particular term that you're referring to.
I could expand a little bit. It's essentially what happens is the process, they call them different things, community conversation, natural step as a process, they call natural step out of Sweden. And the process is sitting down with the community, talking about the values that are important to the community, talking about the environmental concerns that exist, and then having the community decide on a vision and a process to develop them. And what this allows is it allows the decisions seems to become a lot less conflict-focused as opposed to growth-focused, and it helps sort of knit these communities together a little bit more effectively, because we find our communities mostly fight about things. They're really good at that. They're not particularly good at pushing progressive ideas.
Emmanuel, you're breaking up, I'm afraid.
Oh, I'm sorry. Is it any better now? Can you hear me?
Yeah, that's better.
So one of the principles of the 12 principles of transition towns is actually the use of... So I'm sure some of you would have heard of it, but open space technology is basically a facilitation...
I would just say that... you know, in terms of collaborative, the way you described it, frankly, is good community economic development practice. I think there's many examples of where that kind of process is working in Canada and the United States and kind of as an anchor off for processes. It's insufficient, but it is an important piece of building that kind of set of linkages. I think transition towns have some potential for animating and organizing at the local level in ways that build those bridges as well. And certainly where they're most advanced, they are also, because of the numbers of people becoming involved, also securing some interest on the part of municipalities. So I think there's a number of different methodologies, there's a number of things going on, but I think it is important. One thing I'd just like to say, Rupert, if I could, that I think one of the things that is really problematic, well, let me just say that one of the most absolutely amazing cases that I have studied now is in Kristianstad, Sweden, which has 24 municipalities, the lowest line area in Sweden. There's 33,000 people in the area of Kristianstad, but it's a district municipality which has another 24 communities right down to a size of 150. In 1999, the municipal council said that they had a major political priority, which was to become fossil fuel free. If you go to look at Kristianstad, and I'll put it up here, you will see some absolutely what's possible. They're producing biogas, biofuels, all kinds of different district and individual building heating systems based on renewables. They're probably in around 500 gigawatts now of wind power. But the key to putting this together has been the locally owned, municipally owned waste management company and the municipally owned utility. That has been what's allowed them to continuously reinvest and leverage resources on a focused way from senior level government and private sector in order to keep this kind of process going for the last 10 years. So I'm just kind of ending, I guess, with this ownership question. Herb raised the question a little earlier about, on the chat line about, is there some problem with going to a corporate form or a municipal ownership versus a nonprofit or a cooperative ownership. Now, the example of Kristianstad, which I think can inspire many municipalities, shows absolutely fundamentally and importantly the absolutely crucial role of local ownership, however it is owned, and whatever collaboration brings it into focus strategically around, making these kinds of huge long-term efforts that are required to transition us up where the treadmill we're on now.
Great. Thanks, Mike. So I think we have time just for one final question or comment from our participants. Okay, well, I'm not hearing any at this point. I want to thank everybody for their participation and a great turnout today, and I think this theme and this subject is going to continue to be very significant for all of us. and will continue to be a significant focus of the Canadian social economy research work. And of course, Balters and Transition Towns and many of your organizations that you're representing today here on the call. So thanks to our speakers who gave, I think, excellent, shared some excellent points and addressed the questions that this set. Just remind everybody that there will be an MP3 file online on the web page of the Canadian Social Economy Hub so that people can use that in any way they wish and can promote it to colleagues in their own organizations or others. So there'll be further resources available on our website on the subject in the coming months. So thanks again, everybody, and we'll keep the chatsy room open for a while so that people can keep chatting online, and you're very welcome to do that, and we'll check that and see if there are any questions that people are posing that they didn't have time to bring up on the call, and we'll get back to anybody that does raise any questions or suggest any resources so that everybody can get that information. So we'll close the tele-learning session now before TELUS cuts us off, and thanks, everybody.
Thank you. It's been excellent.
Thank you, Rupert.
Thank you.
Thank you.
That's Mike and Emmanuel.
Oh, bye-bye.
See
bye.
You, Jerry.
Thank you very much. That was very interesting.
Thank you, everybody.
Yep. Hello?